Now that we've made the proclamation, Lord, lead me. Now that we've asked, Lord, use me. Now that we've stated, here I am, wholly available, you say, I think you guys just set me up. That's true. It's so easy to sing those words and from the heart, in the moment of emotion, really mean it. God, if you want to take me on a journey, I'll go. God, if you want to do something through me, I'll volunteer. God, I am completely and totally at your disposal. And then to kind of walk out into real life and say, yeah, that's a religious feeling. That's a spiritual motive. But what about the reality of life? In our home, we have a saying that gets used frequently, particularly in the presence of mom and dad giving directives to children. Actually, sometimes it happens when wife is giving directions to husband too, but most frequently it happens when mom and dad are giving directions to children. They say, yes, but. Yes, but. That's really effective, you know. It's a good way of looking at things. Yes to whatever you said. I'm not going to defy you, disagree with you, or argue. Yes, but. Let me tell you why I can't do or won't do what you're asking me. Yes, but. Yes, but. That's called an excuse. You know, people are great at making excuses. I think of the little boy who was overheard here talking to himself as he walked through the backyard with his baseball bat over his shoulder, his cap on backwards, and the baseball in his hand, saying to himself, I am the greatest hitter that ever lived. Babe Ruth, move over. Roger Maris, watch out. Sammy Sosa, Mark McGwire, I laugh at you. The boy threw the baseball up in the air and swung, missed the ball clean. Didn't deter him at all. Picked the ball up, smiling again, threw the ball up in the air, missed the ball again. Strike two. Smiling, laughing, whistling, take me out to the ball game. Picked the ball up, threw it up in the air, swung again, strike three. You know what the little boy said? Man, that pitcher is hot today. Excuses. Rationalizations. When God taps you on the shoulder and he says, okay, I'll take you up on that. I'm going to lead you. I'm going to use you. I'm going to do something through you. What do you say? Well, when God said that to Moses in the book of Exodus, Moses was not interested. And when we read the story of Moses, it's real easy for us to say, man, Moses, I mean, come on. God's talking to you. God's telling you to do it. God's giving you an opportunity here. Don't blow it, man. Don't blow it. But if you were Moses, what would you do? The guy is 80 years old. He's ready for retirement. In fact, he's past retirement age by our standards. But you see, when God says, refire, Moses says, no, I'd rather retire. God, where were you 40 years ago when I was ready to do something? I was ready then. I was excited. I was capable. I had all that I needed. I was ready to go. And you didn't invite me. You didn't show up. You didn't help me out. Now here you show up in the desert and you're asking me to do something. You've got to be kidding me. Man is one thing, but are you going to supply geritol for all these years? Are you going to provide the preparation H for the rest of my life? I've got a long way to go to lead the people out of Israel. And I'm not willing to do that. He begins to make excuses. And when we get to chapter 4 of Exodus, I see three excuses that Moses makes that I have made myself many times. When I heard the voice of God call, I made the same excuses. And I'll bet you have too. Let's look at Exodus chapter 4. Starting in verse 1, and we're going to look at the first 17 chapters, and you're going to see three great excuses. fact, if you haven't thought of them, I may be giving you some ammunition that you don't really need this morning. But I think you probably have. In Exodus chapter 4, Moses is talking to God, and God is telling him, I want you to go deliver the people. And Moses has already made two excuses, and he gives three more, and God answers all three of those. We see the first excuse in verse 1. Moses answered, what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say the Lord did not appear to you? What's his excuse? Moses' excuse is, I'm not credible. I'm not credible. Who would ever believe me? Who would ever follow me? What if they don't listen to me? I'm not credible. Now, to show you that the issue is belief, if you look in verse 1 and circle the word belief, it's going to come up three more times in this section. Listen to what God says. Then the Lord said to him, what is in your hand? Staff, he replied. And the Lord said, throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. The Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out his hand and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. This, said the Lord, is that they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Then the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was leprous like snow. Now put it back into your cloak, he said. So Moses put his hand back into his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, if they do not believe you or pay attention to the first miraculous sign, then they may believe the second. But if they do not believe those two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. So the issue is credibility. Moses is saying, hey, I'm going to go back home and I'm going to tell these people, the Lord appeared to me, Yahweh is his name, and they're not going to listen to me. They're not going to follow me. He doesn't believe that he can do it. Now, that's a rather bold statement for him to make. Particularly remembering that in chapter 3, verse 18, just prior, what had God told him? He said, go speak to the leaders of Israel, and what will happen? God said, they will believe you. So Moses is now contradicting God. God has told him very clearly, they're going to believe you. And Moses is saying, but what if they don't believe me? He's not prepared to live by faith. So God is going to give him some help. I think it's amazing when you look through Scripture. God calls us to a pure calling of faith. But frequently, when our faith fails, God gives us something extra to give us the confidence to go forward and do what he's asked us to do. Now, is that a positive thing? No, I believe God is accommodating Moses here, but he accommodates him with three incredible signs. The first thing God says to Moses is, what is that in your hand? And the answer to this question is important. Because the staff in Moses' hand is really nothing at all. It's a piece of wood. It's a shepherd's crook. All it is something, a tool for him to use in leading the sheep and fending off varmints or animals that would prey on the sheep. It's simply a stick of wood. You could discard that stick of wood, go get another one. You could find them any place, anytime, anywhere. It means nothing. It's just a stick of wood while it's in the hand of Moses. And what does God say to Moses? Notice verse 3, the Lord said, throw it on the ground. When Moses released that stick out of his hand and threw it on the ground, something supernatural happened. The staff turns into a snake. And it's not just any old snake. It must be some kind of a poison viper because Moses actually runs away from it. He's scared. He flees. He tries to get away. Then God says to him, hey, pick up the snake. But he tells him to pick it up by the tail. Now, I don't know if there's any crazy Texans in here that go on those weird rattlesnake expeditions, you know, where they go out and spend a day reaching into the crevices and rocks and collecting rattlesnakes. And that was one of my first exposures to Texas when I was reading in the paper about people in Texas catching rattlesnakes for fun. Anybody who's ever done that, you know that the last place to grab a rattlesnake is by the rattler. Don't grab a snake by the tail, because that gives the snake a great ability to do what? To turn around and inject you with whatever he's carrying in his fangs. But Moses is told to reach down and take the snake by the tail. What is God doing with Moses? He's saying, Moses, you don't have enough faith to go lead my people. Let's see if you have enough faith to pick up your staff. Now remember, when it was in Moses' hand, it was nothing but a staff. I mean, Moses ought to have enough faith to reach down and pick up his staff, right? Well, it's changed form. It's a little different. And so God is working with Moses to kind of ease him into this thing, to help him get prepared. Moses reaches down and he picks up the snake by the tail, and the snake becomes his staff again. Now there's a lot of significance to this symbol, because the snake meant two very different things to the two groups that Moses was going to talk to. To the one group, the nation of Israel, the snake represented evil. Remember who appeared to Eve in the garden? It was a serpent. And the snake was loathed by the nation of Israel as the representation, the incarnation of Satan himself. And what Moses was going to be saying, when he could throw his snake down in the, or his staff down in the presence of people, and it would turn into a snake, and then he could grab it by the tail, is that I have control, I have power over evil, power over Satan. But he was also saying something very important to the Egyptians. If you ever have a chance to go back and look through some of your Egyptian paraphernalia, your Egyptian literature, look at the mask of King Tut, you'll notice that on the mask, on the top of the mask, there is a serpent. The snake represented in Egypt the power of the Pharaoh. By throwing the snake down, the stick down, making it a snake, and picking it up by the tail, what Moses was communicating is that we have power over Pharaoh. So God picked a symbol to communicate the power of God. You see, what God is saying here is, when Moses says, I'm not credible, nobody will believe me, I'm not credible, God says, I am powerful. I am powerful. I am powerful. He gives him two more signs in addition to that. The second one is putting his hand into his coat and pulling it out, and it has leprosy on it. Now, leprosy was feared in the ancient world. They believed that it was a disease that could spread easily, and it would just simply eat the body up over a period of time. When Moses pulls his hand out, he's got this dreaded disease. The disease of leprosy in Moses' day would be comparable to the fear that we have when we hear the word cancer in our day. Moses pulls his hand out, leprosy, he puts it back in, it's healed again. What's God communicating? God is saying, I have the power over life and death. I control the physical world. In other words, what God is saying is, I have the power to bring the plagues, and we're going to see that in a couple chapters. The final sign that God gives them is the sign of the water from the Nile. And if you look at verse 9, he said, but if they do not believe these two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. Now the Egyptians worshipped the Nile as the source of life. The Nile flooded its banks every year, and the areas where the Nile flooded its banks was where they planted crops. In the middle of a desert, Egypt flourished simply and only because of the Nile River. And what God is saying through this sign is, you think the Nile is your life? No. Your blood is your life. And in the same way that the Nile floods over its banks and goes back in, I'm going to pour the Nile out on the ground, and it will be blood pouring out on the ground. And what I want to communicate to you is, I have the power over nature. The power over Pharaoh, the power over life and death, and the power over nature. These are the three signs given to Moses. God is saying, I am powerful. Now, you may be saying, yeah, but I can't make a stick turn into a snake. You know, I can't stick my hand in my coat and pull it out and leprosy and put it back in and it goes away. I can't pour water on the ground and have it turn to blood. I mean, Moses had an advantage. He developed credibility because he had these special signs. Now, some of you may not realize this, but God has given us some signs in our day, too. God has given us some powerful and incredible signs to communicate the truth of who He is and what He's doing in our life. The first and the most significant sign of all for the believer is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. The resurrection of Jesus Christ. Notice what Paul says. Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel." Why? Because it is the power of God for salvation of everyone who believes, first for the Jew and then for the Gentile. Now let's stop and think about what he's saying here. He's saying, I'm not embarrassed to proclaim the good news, the gospel. What is the gospel? Paul defines the gospel in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 very, very clearly. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, that the gospel is the death, the burial, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And Paul says, as I go out as a missionary to tell the good news, I am not ashamed that my Christian faith is not credible. Because there is one event that took place in history, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that is unexplainable. Nobody else has ever done it before. Nobody else has ever replicated it. Nobody else has explained it away. The resurrection of Jesus Christ stands as a supreme testimony that God has the power over life and death. And God holds that power in His hand. So Paul says, I'm not ashamed. The gospel of Jesus Christ is credible to me, and I am not afraid to proclaim it. The second and significant sign that we've been given is the changed lives of the people who've received the gospel. Notice what Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. He says, "You yourselves are our letters, written on our hearts, known and read by everybody. You show that you are a letter from Christ, the result of our ministry, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on the tablets of stone, but on the tablets of the human heart." Now, what are the letters Paul's referring to? He's talking about letters of reference, letters of accommodation. He's saying, we don't need credentials. We don't need degrees. We don't need some kind of a group backing us. We don't need all of these signs and the fantastic things, because we've got something that is more incredible. And that is the people we've ministered to. Their lives have been changed by the gospel of Jesus Christ. And the only thing that can truly change a heart, the only thing that can truly shape a life, is the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ. A number of years ago, there was a man who was miraculously converted at the Bowery Mission in New York City. Prior to his conversion, this man had gained the reputation of just being a terrible derelict. He was an alcoholic, wino, lived on the street. He lived like an animal. And this man came to faith in Jesus Christ, and when he came to faith, everything changed. The man's name was Joe, and he started to just hang around the mission and help out in any way he could. And this guy would do anything. Every day he would come in, and he would work in the mission, and he pretty much just kind of lived there and took care of people. He was the one who was willing to clean up the vomit after a man came in and emptied himself right there in the middle of the mission. He cleaned the bathrooms. There was no task that was too bad or too difficult or too dirty that he wouldn't do it. Night after night, he would take those men, the winos that were there, and he would clean them up, undress them, put them into bed. He was always there helping, serving, caring, and loving. One day, the director of the mission was preaching an evangelistic message to the men there at the mission. You got to listen to the sermon before you can eat. Preaching the message to the men at the mission, and one man began to break into tears. And at the end of the service, he came down to the front, and he knelt at the front, and he was saying something under his breath over and over and over and over and over again. The leader of the mission went down to the man. When he got close to him, got down beside him, realized this man was, he was a drunk and he was in a terrible state, but he kept saying something over and over again. He kept saying, "I want to be like Joe. I want to be like Joe. I want to be like Joe." The speaker there looked at the man and he said, "Don't you want to be like Jesus?" And the man looked at him in the face with as serious as faces could be, and he said, "Is Jesus anything like Joe?" See, he'd never seen Jesus before, but he saw the changed life of Joe. And he wanted that. And that is a powerful testimony. You say, show me a sign. Show me a sign. I've got two of them for you. Number one, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Top that. Number two, the sign I have is the lives of the people of Hill Country Bible Church and how God has changed my life and how He's changed your life and how He's changing us day after day after day. Whenever God calls you and you say, well, I'm not credible, who will listen to me? God says to you, but I am. I am. Second excuse that Moses comes up with here is the excuse, I'm not capable. Notice what he says in verses 10 and 11. Moses said to the Lord, O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. Now here's what Moses is saying. The word eloquent means a man of words. He said, I've never been a man of words. I've never been real good at talking my way out of anything. Maybe Moses is thinking back to the time when he was there and he was standing in the presence of those two Hebrews. And the one Hebrew looked him in the face and said, who made you ruler and judge over us? And Moses doesn't even answer. There's not even a word recorded. The implication is Moses didn't even know what to say. He couldn't even defend himself verbally. He couldn't even explain to the guy, well, you know, I'm trying to help you. My name is Moses. I was the one who was drawn out. Moses just turns and leaves. He's got nothing to say. He says, I'm not a man of words. And he also goes on to say, I'm not a man of delivery. Notice he says in verse 10, he says, I am slow of speech and tongue. Literally, what that means is I am thick-tongued and thick-lipped. My mouth doesn't articulate. I can't get it out. I can't say anything. Now, the probability here is Moses is exaggerating, but at least in his mind, he is convinced that he is not capable of doing what God asked him to do. You ever feel that way? You ever feel the Holy Spirit tapping you on the shoulder and saying, I want you to step out and lead? And you think, oh man, I don't know how to do that. I've never led. I've never led anybody. I can't do that. I'm not capable. Or God says, I want you to teach. You say, what would I say? I mean, I can't even talk. Funny thing that I experienced when I was teaching the journeyman class on what it means to be a man and a father, how many men communicated how incapable they felt of really being a spiritual leader, making a spiritual contribution to their wife and children. God, you're calling me, but I just don't feel adequate. I don't feel capable. Notice what God says to Moses. God says to Moses in verse 11, the Lord said, who gave man his mouth? Then he says something that is very, very important. He asks the question, who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now, that's very important for your theology. Because many of us believe that if something bad happens to somebody, or somebody is not completely capable, or doesn't have it all, that that is a fluke of nature. Nature messed up. That's a random thing. This scripture is telling us that God has chosen to make us exactly the way we are, defect and all. Remember when Jesus was talking to his disciples in John chapter 9? And they walked up and they saw this man sitting there that was blind, and the disciples, using the theology that was popular of the day, asked Jesus the question, who messed up that this man was born blind? Who sinned? Was it his fault? Did he do something wrong and then he was cursed with blindness? Or was it his parents? Did they do something wrong and he was cursed with blindness? What does Jesus say in John chapter 9? He said, neither. He said, this man was born blind so that the power of God could be revealed in him. You know what Jesus is saying? The place where you see God's power most clearly portrayed is at our weakest points. And in the area where you feel the least capable, that's the place where God can display the most power. Now, according to the world standards, we measure our abilities in terms of our gifting. But according to God's standards, He often measures our ability in accordance to our weaknesses. We are capable where we are weak. And that ought to be an incredibly encouraging message. If you don't like the way you are, If you feel like you're inadequate, that God didn't give you what you needed, you're wrong. God, who entered into a relationship with you before the foundation of the world, Psalm 139 said, "You saw my unformed substance. In my mother's womb, you saw me. You formed me. You knit me together. You have known me. You made me exactly the way you wanted me to be. That's who I am. Just the way you wanted me to be. Whatever capabilities or whatever weaknesses I have." And far too many of us spend our whole life depending on our strength to make us successful. And God says, when I call you to do something significant for me, oftentimes I will use your weakness, because that's where I will display my glory. Notice how he says it in the end of verse 11. He says, "Is it not I, the Lord?" Here we have a word play again on the holy name, I am. He says, "Is it not I am who is speaking to you?" I am the ever-present, all-powerful God who's already promised to be with you. I am. I'm the Lord. I know what's wrong with your mouth. I know what you're capable of doing. Notice then how he finishes up in verse 12. He says, "Now go, and I will help you speak, and I will teach you what to say." In other words, I will give you the content. I will teach you what to say. And I will give you the ability to deliver it. I will make your mouth be capable of speaking. Don't worry about it, Moses. When Moses says, "I am not capable," God says, "I am present with you. I am present with you. I made your mouth. I'll teach you what to say, and I'll even give you the ability to say it well." What an incredible promise. Now let me just speak for a moment to those who are here who make excuses because they're overly capable. You know what I mean. God calls you and taps you on the shoulder and says, "I want you to serve in an area that you feel is below your gifting." See, we've been trained by our culture to think that if you ever do anything that is below your gifting, you are wasting yourself. And far too many people are wasting themselves doing nothing for the kingdom because they certainly would not want to waste themselves on something less than what they're capable of doing. You who find yourself great eloquent orators, excellent teachers, able to convey great and powerful and mighty thoughts about theology, try teaching three-year-olds for a while. You will find out. You will find out that that is not beneath you. Because if you can communicate the truths of God to three-year-olds, you're good. Then you're good. And you know what you're going to find out? Your inadequacy is really the issue. I don't feel comfortable in that environment. That's really the issue. Not that I'm too good for that, but I don't feel comfortable there. Don't ever find yourself so overqualified in your own eyes that you're no good to God, because you certainly wouldn't want Him to waste you on something less than what you're capable of. This brings us to the third excuse, which I believe is the real issue. Notice in verse 13, Moses says, "Oh Lord, please send someone else to do it." Now, this is his fifth objection. Five times now, he's come up with something. And finally, he just gets to the bottom line. And you know what it is? He says, "I'm not committed. I'm not committed. Hey, let somebody else do this job. That is not where I'm at in my life. God, maybe you don't understand, but, you know, I've been tending these sheep, and I'm, you know, a good 15 years past retirement age. This is not where I am in life. Don't call me to do this. You don't understand. The golden years have come. I'm ready to retire to the tent. I'm ready for the sand traps of the Sahara. Send someone else. There's got to be, in all of the world, there's got to be someone else." To that, God does something that feels a little extreme until you understand the whole truth Notice in verse 14, the Lord's anger burned against Moses. God got mad. Now you notice with every single other excuse that Moses gives, God patiently gives him an answer. Not always the answer he likes, but God patiently gives him an answer. When he gives this excuse, send someone else. Don't bother me with this. This is not my fight anymore. Send someone else. I don't care. I'm not committed. God gets angry. And I believe that there are two reasons why God gets angry. I believe the first reason that God gets angry is because God sees a lack of care and concern in Moses. The man who once was so concerned for his people that he went out and actually took matters in his own hands and lost the opportunity to live in the palace, now has gotten to a point where he is so calloused to the cry of his people and the plan of God. He's so callous to that, he doesn't care anymore. And folks, that's easy for us to do. It's easy for us to move away from our spiritual passion. It's easy for us to look back to a time when our hearts yearned and burned for the things of God. When if God would have given us the opportunity, tapped us on the shoulder, said, I want to do something important and significant through you, you would have jumped up and down and said, oh, right, goody, goody, let's go. But back when you were hot, when you were fired up, when you were motivated, God paused. He gave you some time to mature. He gave you some time to grow up. He gave you some time to get some learning under your belt. He gave you some time to be patient. And the fire began to die. And God taps you on the shoulder again and you say, hey, send someone else. God is very angry when he sees us lose compassion and motivation for the things that are priority. I believe the other reason why God is angry is because out of all the people in the world, God's picked Moses to give him the privilege of being the deliverer. This is not a task. This is an opportunity. Can you imagine sitting down with Moses in heaven? If he would have turned this opportunity down, if he would have walked away, if he would have said, I'm not going to do it, can you imagine sitting down with him and listening in eternity to the regret of his life for not following through? You see, God is angry because God is giving him a chance for greatness, a chance to do something significant, a chance to experience something that nobody in the world will ever experience. And Moses says, send someone else. Moses doesn't see the privilege. And many times the reason why we're not committed is because when the call of God comes, we view it as a burden rather than an opportunity. We don't see the privilege. And consequently, God is giving us the opportunity to do something incredible for Him. And we're saying, send someone else. Send someone else. I often struggle through the process that we go through each year as we select elders for our church, and we're in the middle of praying through that process, and we select two elders for our church every year, and it's invariably when we talk to people about serving as elder, there will be a number of people that we'll talk to who will tell us, well, you know, where I'm at in life and what I got going on and what I'm doing and this thing's coming up at work and I got this thing in my education and this stuff and, you know, kind of going through that, and, you know, somebody else can do it. And I'm not suggesting that there isn't a bad time for someone to step into that area of leadership. And that's why we only have two new elders each year. I think God is handpicks them, and we work through that process. And seldom does anybody ever become an elder the first year that we begin the interview process. Usually it takes several years. But the thing that always surprises me is when I run into someone who very casually says, send someone else. I've got too many other things going on. I don't really need to pray about this because, my life is full. And you know what I think? Peter tells the elders in 1 Peter chapter 5 that as you serve well as an elder in the church of Jesus Christ, that there's going to come a time when the chief shepherd will appear. And he will place an unfading crown of glory on the heads of those people who were willing to lead at that level in the church. In other words, Jesus is going to have a special recommendation and commendation for the people who were willing to give of themselves at that level. And I think, Is that a burden or a privilege? Is that an opportunity? Or what? The promise of God to reward people for serving in that role. And to many people, they say, boy, that level of commitment, man, that's a burden. That's not a burden. It's a blessing. God accommodates Moses. Notice what he says. He says in verse 14, the Lord's anger burned against Moses and said, what about your brother Aaron the Levite? I know he can speak well. He is already on his way to meet you, and his heart will be glad when he sees you. You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will help both of you speak and will teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so that you can perform the miraculous signs with it. God accommodates Moses. He says, if you don't feel like you can do it by yourself, that's okay. I knew this day was coming. I knew what you were going to say. I've already picked Aaron. I told him where you were, and he's on his way. He's already coming to meet you. If you don't want to do it by yourself, I'll accommodate you. But keep in mind that this is an accommodation. Because Aaron is not going to be the best helper. For those of you who know the rest of the story, Aaron is the one who puts together the golden calf. Aaron is the one who complains against Moses later on, and God has to strike Miriam with leprosy to remind Miriam and Aaron that Moses is his spokesman. Because Aaron starts to say, well, who says God only speaks through Moses? Aaron will be a thorn in his side. And God is going to show Moses through Aaron what it feels like to work with somebody who is not dedicated to the task. And all of these things, God says to him, I am persistent. When Moses says, I'm not committed, God says, I am persistent. I'm going to stay after you. I'm going to follow you the rest of your life. And if I have to even accommodate the plan to make sure that you get involved, I'm going to involve you. And that's the kind of loving God we serve. God's the kind of God who's not going to let us walk away from every opportunity to do something with our lives. And He'll keep coming after us, and He'll keep coming after us, and He'll keep coming after us until we finally plug in and move forward. By keeping our eyes on the I Am, we gain confidence to fulfill our calling. And that's our responsibility. You are credible. You are capable. You are committed if you allow God to work in you and work through your lives. God is calling you today. I'm not sure what it is. Maybe something dramatic. Linda Buckley has just spent a couple weeks over in Central Asia. Linda Buckley is a widow in our church who quit her job, good job at IBM a couple years ago to pursue God's calling. And she's very seriously considering spending the next 2 years working in development of our mission over in Central Asia. And she's been over there working with that. And God may call you to do something outrageous, something dramatic. Or God may call you to do something that appears to be minor, but has an incredible effect on the lives of many people. Called the ripple effect. You know what that is? Well, recently there was a survey of pastors, and a startling percentage of pastors said that they did not feel like they saw results from their ministry. They didn't see God really working. I don't have that problem. I see you guys every week. I see you during the week. I see God working all over the place. Well, let me share a story with you about the ripple effect. There was a Sunday school teacher named Edward Kimball. And he wasn't sure his life made any consequence at all. But in 1859, he was able to lead at least one guy to Christ, a shoe clerk by the name of Dwight L. Moody. Moody became an evangelist. Moody started the Moody Bible Institute. And in 1879, Moody awakened an evangelistic zeal in the heart of a pastor, F.B. Meyer, who was a pastor of a small church in New England. While Meyer was preaching on a college campus, he led Wilbur Chapman to Christ. And Wilbur Chapman began to work in the local YMCA, where he employed an evangelist by the name of Billy Sunday, a former baseball player, to help lead a series of services that he was doing in Charlotte, North Carolina. A group of local men were so enthused by the meeting that they brought in another preacher to do a later evangelistic meeting, and the other preacher's name was Mordecai F. Ham. And during one of those meetings, there was a young man who walked the aisle and prayed to receive Christ. His name is Billy Graham. Now that chain all started back with Edward Kimball, a Sunday school teacher who led a shoe clerk to Jesus Christ. And the rest is history. If I polled this room, I believe that there will be at least one person who's a believer today because of Billy Graham's ministry. So you owe your roots to Edward Kimball. If God calls, answer the call. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we hear you calling. The calling may be something as average, normal, regular, everyday. It's teaching children on Sunday morning. Or it might be something as dramatic and strange and unusual and bizarre as traveling to Central Asia. But either way, your voice is your voice. And when your voice calls, give us the faith and the courage to follow. Father, may there be no more yes buts from this congregation, from my heart. May our answer simply be yes. And may our lives be lives that follow you. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.